This training is an introduction to the associated online guidance document, Bioavailability of Contaminants in Soil, Considerations for Human Health Risk Assessment. This guidance was produced by ITRC in 2017. Although we were able to share a lot of information with you today, we certainly will not be able to share all the tools and resources available in this guidance. So we strongly encourage you to look at the guidance if you haven't already done so. We hope it will serve as a resource for you as you're working on your environmental sites. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. Today's training is scheduled for about 2 hours and 15 minutes. We are also recording this event to make it available on demand for those who are not able to make it today. Trainers will be in control of the slides as we move through today's training session. If you'd like to control your own slides, you are able to download the slides from the initial training page you were directed to today. You can also access the slides by going to the related links section on the right-hand side of your screen, clicking on the CLUIN training page, and then clicking Browse To. We want to hear from everybody today, both your questions and your feedback. We have two question and answer opportunities throughout this training, one about halfway through the training session and another at the end. However, at any time today, you can feel free to ask your question in the Q&A area located in the lower right-hand corner of your screen. We will try to answer as many of those questions as we can verbally during the question and answer breaks. If we have too many questions to answer out loud, we will ask our trainers to respond directly back to you in writing through the Q&A area. For those of you on the phone line, if you would like to ask a question out loud, we will also give you an opportunity to do so during the Q&A breaks. At that time, we will remind you that it's #6 to unmute. There is also an online feedback form for you to complete to let us know how the training went today. By completing this feedback form, you will be eligible to receive your certificate of completion to support your documentation of continuing education. At the end of the feedback form, you will be able to certify that you participated today. Once you complete the form, a certificate will be issued to you. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of the States. We are a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses, such as the one you are participating on today. If you would like to be a part of ITRC, please visit our website or feel free to contact us directly. On our website, you can register for teams and learn more about how you can be an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on the ITR website. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we do ask that you review the policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material or endorse any specific products. Moving on to slide number 5, it is now time to meet our trainers for today. We will be hearing from these experts throughout our training session, and a very special thanks to them, as they are not only serving as trainers for today's session, but they've also served as trainers for past sessions. They've spent many years working with ITRC to develop the associated guidance document, so we thank them for taking time out of their busy schedules to share their expertise with us today. The trainers are Jeff Siemering from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Anita Meyer from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Kevin Long from Terraphase Engineering, Valerie Hanley from the California Department of Toxic Substances Control, and Barry Selko from Jacobs. If you'd like to read more about their expertise, you can access their bios through the link at the bottom of the page. You can also access their trainers' bios in the related link section by clicking on the CLUIN training page and then clicking Browse To. Their bios are located at the bottom of that webpage. So with that said, let's move on to the next slide, and I will pass it off to Jeff. Hi, Jeff. Remember, it is #6 to unmute. Hi everyone, if you can just hold on for one moment. We're having some technical difficulties with Jeff, but he will be available very shortly. Hi everyone, Jeff got disconnected, so he's calling back in, but we'll start in just a moment.
Hello, everyone. My apologies for my technical difficulties. Slide six, here's the training map for today's training, or the roadmap. I'm going to cover the importance of evaluating bioavailability in soils, and then I'll pass it off to Anita Meyer, and she will go move forward with bioavailability basics. So let me just jump right in with the concept of bioavailability. So really what it boils down to is the idea here is that not all of a contaminant ingested with soil is going to move into the bloodstream. The schematic on the right gives you a conceptual overview of what's going on. So you somehow ingest contaminated soil, and people eat a lot more soil than they think they do. The soil goes into the GI tract, and essentially, if you think about it in your stomach with the acid there, you're doing an acid digestion on the soil. So some portion of that contaminant is going to come free from the soil and be in the acid in your stomach, and then as it moves through the GI system. So that portion of the metal is called bioaccessible, meaning it's possible and available for it to move into the bloodstream and into tissues in the body, but it hasn't yet. As it moves through the GI system, you can have systemic absorption, and that's really the bioavailable fraction. That's the part that's actually moved into the body. Molly, can you pull up the poll question? Oh, there it is. So if people could vote on that, if a contaminant is ingested and passes through the human GI tract, does it actually contribute to systemic risk? So most of you are saying no, and that's correct. If it doesn't go into the body and just passes through, it doesn't contribute to systemic risk. And this is what we're going to be covering throughout this training. So what we're hoping you will learn in this training is to value the ITRC document as a go-to resource for soil bioavailability, learn how to apply the decision process to determine when a site-specific bioavailability assessment may be appropriate, use the checklist in it to develop or review a risk assessment that includes soil bioavailability. We're going to delve into some specific factors dealing with arsenic, lead, and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon bioavailability, and hopefully you'll get a better understanding of those. We want you to learn how to be able to select the appropriate methods to do a bioavailability study, and then at the end, be able to take that bioavailability data and drop into a human health risk assessment. So you might wonder, why are we even bothering to consider evaluating bioavailability in soils? First and foremost, it reduces uncertainty in the risk assessment process. It's going to provide a more accurate understanding of chemical exposures and the associated risk. It's going to lead to a more effective use of resources without compromising human health. And that phrase in there, without compromising human health, is really important. Some of the concepts in this are a little subtle, especially for the general public, and you're going to have to really work on bringing your community stakeholders along on the process and explaining all of that to them. Hopefully, it's going to reduce remedial action costs and increase flexibility of remedial options. Hopefully, you can just focus your funding on the spots that really need to be remediated and not waste money on areas that really don't. And also, site-specific risk assessment will allow for modifying exposure factors to better represent site conditions. You're just going to be generating better data for your risk assessment. So here's a shot of the page of the ITRC guidance document. We're really suggesting after this training that you go back and review that. It'll be really helpful. It's not put together as a giant PDF that you have to scroll through. It's broken down with various links, so you can access the information that you need really quickly. It was put together over about 2.5 years by a group of regulators, academic scientists, and consultants. So we really think there's a lot of really great information in there. So the focus of the training and the guidance today, it's the bioavailability of contaminants in soil to humans, specifically focused on human health. If you're needing information on bioavailability in sediment or reference to ecological receptors, there's a whole separate training for that. You can go through the ITRC website to access that. We're going to specifically be drilling down and covering arsenic, lead, and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. These are contaminants of high interest with enough data to be applicable to a wide range of remediation scenarios. Now, the protocols that are being used can be used to assess bioavailability of other contaminants, but you're going to have to do some more research on your own to find the correct methods and comparative studies. This training is going to focus on the soil ingestion pathway. It's not going to deal with plant uptake or foodstuff consumption. We are going to discuss dermal bioavailability to a small extent as it relates to PAHs. Lead and arsenic are assumed to have virtually no dermal bioavailability, but the organic PAH molecules do. The tools that you'll have at the end of this training. First and foremost, we think, is our web-based guidance document. Again, great information in there and easy to access. The webinar handouts, you've also received the decision flowchart that's part of the guidance document, and which we'll be walking through in both of the case studies covered later. There's an extensive definition of terms. We think this is important because this field, this type of study, covers multiple scientific fields. So you might be really familiar with some and totally unfamiliar with others. So it's definitely worth reviewing that. There'll also be a review checklist that you can use as a tool to review bioavailability assessment and to prepare your own bioavailability study. So this is basically a testimonial from another trainer who usually has conducted this portion of the training. He's a geologist with Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, and a number of years ago got to experience doing a bioavailability study while working at a 17-mile stretch of road that was determined to have been, the roadbed was made from arsenic containing mine waste. The road had been decommissioned, and that stretch had been split up between multiple properties. He hadn't used bioavailability in an assessment before. With the first assessment, with the default parameters, basically the result was that all of that former roadbed was going to have to be dug up and taken care of that way. So the responsible party brought in a consultant, and this consultant recommended doing a bioavailability assessment. The regulator was on board, responsible parties on board, community was okay with it, so they moved forward and did that. And it turns out the site-specific risk assessment presented much lower risk than the previous estimates from the default estimates. So they were able to move forward in that way. This significantly reduced remedial action costs. Some sites still needed to be remediated, but many did not. And they had really increased the accuracy of their risk assessment. And Molly, is the question up? Oh, yep, it is. And so I see that most of you have little or no experience or some experience with bioavailability. That's great. At the end of this, you'll actually have a pretty solid foundation for moving forward with using bioavailability in your risk assessment. And now I'm going to hand it over to Anita Meyer, who's going to delve more into the basics of bioavailability.
Hey, thank you, Jeff, and good morning, good afternoon to everyone, depending on what part of the country you're in. I'm in Omaha, Nebraska, and it's been snowing for 3 days in a row. But I'm happy to be here. I'm in a beautiful conference room overlooking the Missouri River. So I am going to cover bioavailability basics in this part of the presentation. I'm going to go through some of the history of bioavailability, how it came to light that it could be a thing that that you might ingest a certain concentration of a chemical in soil, but not all of it gets into your bloodstream and goes to parts of the body where it may cause harm. I'm going to talk about the relevance in human health risk assessment and how we handle the bioavailability of a chemical in those calculations. I'm going to talk about how it may be applicable to several different types of chemicals, although we're only talking about a few in this training today. I'm going to introduce a couple key definitions. I'm going to talk about developing a correlation between in vitro measurement of bioaccessibility and correlating that to in vivo bioavailability. And then also I'm going to introduce and talk a little bit about soil properties that might influence bioavailability. So lead is probably one of the longest known chemicals that it is toxic. And I think many of us are familiar with the fact that measuring lead in blood is a very common parameter for assessing whether or not someone's been exposed to a significant amount of lead. And there are studies performed on different types of soils, and that they then related to the blood lead concentrations of people who were exposed to them. And we have here some smelter studies, and we see that there's the higher the change in lead, the higher the change in the lead in blood. So, and then urban soil studies are a little different. There's less of a correlation there, that it took more of lead in those type of soils to have high blood lead, and then mining soil studies even less. So it seemed to be that there was some differences in the source of lead and how much lead was present in the blood. So then there's further demonstration of relative bioavailability of lead in soils demonstrated in animal models. And this is a study that looks at soluble lead versus lead in soil at differing concentrations. And we can see here that lower doses of soluble lead, in this case it was lead acetate, resulted in lower lead levels. And here we have 225 was the concentration of lead, and it was dosed over a little over 2 weeks, and we could see the blood lead of the animals raising, going up. But when they were dosed with a lesser amount, it didn't get as high. Not a surprise. But what's interesting is what we see in lead with soil. When you compare the same concentration of soluble lead acetate, dosed over a little over 2 weeks, to the same concentration of lead in soil, much, much less blood lead concentrations. So the source of lead definitely mattered. And here again, with a lower concentration of soluble lead, this case it was 75 milligrams per kilogram, and then compare it to the same concentration given to animals over a little over 2 weeks, they had much lower blood lead. So it seemed that there are some important differences on the types of lead exposure and how much lead is actually getting into, not getting into the body systemically, moving throughout the body and causing and having the ability to cause toxic effects. If you ingest lead, or in any other chemical, if you ingest a chemical and it just passes through your gut and isn't absorbed, well, it doesn't have much of an opportunity to cause toxic effects. So there's a recognition 30 years ago when risk assessment for guidance with Superfund was published. This is the guidance document published by EPA that many, many site risk assessments follow to assess risk of the chemicals present at a hazardous waste site. So back then, 30 years ago, this document recognized then that the medium of an exposure at a site could differ from the medium exposure that's assumed when the toxicity value was developed. And so, and in certain cases, an adjustment could be warranted. So in when toxicity values are developed, most commonly they are developed by using studies where animals are given doses of chemicals. And it is most common that they might be dosed by putting a chemical in drinking water, in their drinking water, or putting the chemical in their food, or force feeding an animal with the chemical. It is not common at all that they're exposed by feeding the animals chemicals in soil. So there's a big difference in how in that exposure route, and it can influence bioavailability. And we'll get into that more. Okay, so this is the risk assessment paradigm that is used on hazardous waste sites. And here we have the risk assessment portion. We have planning, we plan to collect data, and then we collect the data by taking samples of different media on the site. It could be soil, water, air, and today we're concerned about soil, so I'm gonna kinda keep focusing on that. So we collect the data and we determine the concentrations of the chemicals in soil, and we look at how people might be exposed to them, and we estimate the amount of exposure for different land use scenarios. If it's residences, we look at the type of exposure people living on a site would have, or if it's an industrial site, we may just focus on industrial type worker exposures, and we estimate exposure, and then we combine it with toxicity information. And again, that's the type of information that comes from those studies that determines what doses of the chemical might cause certain effects that would be relevant to humans in those animals. So we combine it with toxicity information and we estimate risk in the risk characterization phase. And that, and why do we estimate risk? Well, it's all used in risk management where the risk information is used with several other characteristics or concerns about the site, and then cleanup levels may be decided, or it may be decided that no action needs to take place. But risk characterization and risk assessment is an important part of the project life cycle of a hazardous waste site. And so that's how all this fits together. And when we're talking about bioavailability, it keys in on the exposure assessment. Of course, it's related to toxicity as well, and I'll get into that. So, bioavailability, it is, as I mentioned earlier, it's a relationship, well, the relative bioavailability, which we're really going to dig into in a couple slides. Relative bioavailability is the relationship between the soil ingestion exposure that we have at our hazardous waste site to the type of exposure that was performed or was the way the animals were exposed to a chemical during the toxicity assessment study that they determined that it caused a certain toxic effect at a certain dose. So we have, when we do a toxicity assessment, we either decide for carcinogens, a cancer slope factor is derived, or for non-carcinogens, we call it a reference dose. And that's just the safe dose is the reference dose that one can be exposed to. A cancer slope factor is the type of toxicity information that we use to determine cancer probabilities. So when and as I mentioned, the toxicity assessment and the exposure assessment information are combined to give that actual risk estimate. So for relative bioavailability, we're looking at how much absorption do we have from contaminants in soil at our site relative to the type of exposure that occurred for that chemical in the animal study. And I'm going to get into a few more details on that. This is the type of calculation that we do. It's a comparison of the chemical from soil, the absolute bioavailability from soil, where we might measure that in a study, versus the bioavailability from the form of that was used to dose in the critical toxicity study. And that could be a bioavailability study that I've been working on for the last couple of years. In that study, the researchers dissolved the chemical, in this case it was PAHs, in a solvent, and then they sprayed it on the animal chow and then dried it off so that no more solvent remained. But what it was the animals were then eating their rat chow, in this case, dosed with the chemical of concern. And so what we would be looking at would be looking at the absolute bioavailability from soil as compared to the bioavailability from that toxicity study. Then once we determine the relative bioavailability, we plug it into the exposure calculations in the risk assessment. And here we have the concentration in soil. We multiply it by the relative bioavailability, be a unitless number like 0.5 or 0.13, times the ingestion rate, times the exposure frequency, the exposure duration, and then it's divided by body weight and averaging time. And then you get a milligram per kilogram per day estimate of the exposure. Okay, so bioavailability could apply to any chemical if you have the data to support it. And this list here came from the Agency for Toxic Substance Disease Registry. They're a subsidiary of the CDC. And this is their substance priority list. And you can see arsenic and lead, high concern. We're going to be addressing them on our training today. And then other chemicals we're going to be addressing are PAHs down here, 8, 9, and 10. But if you had data to support these other chemicals, that there were sufficient studies, you could do a relative bioavailability assessment on those too. The current default for these other chemicals assumes 100% bioavailability, but for arsenic and lead, the default is 60%. But we'll see later in our presentation today that there's other values, that more site-specific values that can be developed and used for those. Okay, some definitions. I've talked about bioavailability. Now I want to talk about bioaccessibility. And they're related, but there are some important differences. The bioaccessibility is the amount of chemical that is soluble or available for uptake in the stomach, in the gut. And there's in vitro methods that can be used to characterize this parameter. They would mimic the gut, be about the same pH, and mimic those characteristics. And so we can estimate bioaccessibility. Some things that might influence bioaccessibility are the size of particle that's ingested, the size of the soil particle if it's in clumps. It may not be as bioaccessible. It may be binding to the soil may influence its bioaccessibility, but it's really just the amount that's available to get out of that soil and into solution. Okay, and here's the schematic, because it can be confusing when you're talking about bioavailability and confusing it with bioaccessibility, and this is an excellent graphic that demonstrates it. So here we have someone eating some contaminated soil. It goes into their GI tract and is dissolved. This is the bioaccessible fraction, the fraction that is able to go into solution. The bioavailable fraction is that crosses this membrane here in the stomach and then is able to go into the GI and be absorbed and go systemically and available to be toxic all over the body. So here's an example here of an in vitro method to measure the bioaccessible fraction, and it's just measuring its solubility in the beaker, which is mimicking the stomach. So we put contaminants in soil into the flask, and then we measure the amount that is dissolved and bioaccessible. For studies of bioavailability, we would have contaminant in soil, we would give it to a test animal, and then we would measure how much was able to, through many different means, measure the amount that was actually absorbed into the system. And that could be through measurements of blood, measurements of primarily blood. And then we measure the amount that has actually gone into circulation. So it can be expensive to do in vivo studies. It's expensive to dose pigs and study them, or monkeys and rodents, but it can be much cheaper if we can find a correlation between an in vitro method, like that flask and the test tube where we measured how much was able to be dissolved, and then be able to correlate it to the bioavailability. I mean, it's no surprise that there would be some degree of correlation between bioaccessibility and bioavailability, because if it doesn't dissolve, it certainly isn't going to be able to be absorbed through that stomach membrane. And this is a graphic that shows bioaccessibility measured in vitro relative to relative bioavailability as measured in vivo. So this is the cheaper in vitro method, and then we correlate it with an in vivo study. And of course, these are not studies that you would be doing on a site-specific basis. These are like research studies that other people might develop, and then you could use them on their on your project once they've been proven to be a good and valid, reliable method. So here we're pretending here that this is an awesome, great method. Well, it is a good one, because this is from the DTSC, from the state of California. So this one, we have measured the in vitro, and then we're going to read off the graph what relative bioavailability it correlates to. So that's how we can use this IVI-VC correlation, the in vitro to in vivo to in vitro correlation, to estimate relative bioavailability. So a good correlation when developing those methods indicates that the in vitro method is going to be a good predictor. A poor correlation, if you had, dots scattered all over that graph and couldn't find a good line to fit it with a good fit, would indicate that it's not a good predictor and likely not a valid surrogate. And so you wouldn't want to use those. I mean, we want valid surrogates to give us, to be able to reduce the amount of uncertainty that we have in our risk assessment relative to bioavailability. So bioavailability can be influenced by different soil properties. So we have here this graphic that shows low to high bioavailability and bioaccessibility. So mineral phases in soil are going to influence it, whether it's lead sulfide and lead phosphate are going to be much lower solubility, much lower bioavailability than lead carbonate. Soil particle size, no surprise. A big soil particle, if it's ingested, it's not going to be able, to be dissolved. There's not going to be as much of it available to go into solution. So it's going to be less bioaccessible, and less bioavailable as well. And here we have small particle sizes, they're very much higher bioaccessibility and bioavailability. Reactive clay oxides, if we have a lot of them, it's going to be not as bioavailable and bioaccessible. and then the amount of encapsulation of the particles in soil and in the soil component. If there's a lot of encapsulation, it's going to be less bioaccessible and less bioavailable. So there's been regulatory recognition of using bioavailability in soil, and EPA has recognized lead and has guidance on that. There's guidance from the EPA on arsenic, some on dioxins, and there's guidance from different states on how to evaluate arsenic. And then there's some site-specific uses that we're beginning to see, you know, with some other chemicals. So we have a poll here. Does the state you work in use bioavailability when assessing risk? So we have the poll up. Now, looks like a lot of us don't know. Well, when at the end of this training, I think you're gonna see some pretty nice results, some huge reductions of project uncertainty that can be had by performing a bioavailability assessment. And I think at the end of this training, you're gonna be urged to, by seeing these results, to find out whether you can perform some of these assessments in your state. Okay, and I am turning it over to the next person now.
Valerie, you on?
Valerie?
Val, you might have to hit #6 to unmute your line if you haven't already.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, sorry. Yes. This is Valerie. You can hear me now?
Yes.
Sorry
over
about
to you
that.
Kevin.
Okay. So Kevin and I are presenting a arsenic case study. We're going to be using this flow chart. This is a figure 4.1 from our guidance document. I believe that this was also provided when you registered for the class. I know it's impossible to read right here, so we're going to go through each one step by step. And in the context of a site. So we're going to start from the very beginning talking about whether or not, you know, what kind of exposures we're looking at and the types of chemicals involved, and moving through cost-benefit analysis and some other further considerations. And so to do this, as I said, we're going to have a case study, and so we're going to have Kevin go ahead and present it. He's going to be playing the role of a consultant presenting a case study, and I'm going to be more of the regulator talking about how we work our way through this. So go ahead, Kevin.
Thanks, Sally. So I guess what I want to do is first tee up a few details about this project. We're currently working on a site. It's a former agricultural parcel. It's about 1,000 acres in size, and you know, as part of its historical use, pesticides were used that we believe contained arsenic. In addition to that, we have some sense of the site and the type of soil that we have at this property, which for the most part is relatively homogeneous. In addition to that, we do have a little bit of details on the usage and the specific activity boundaries at the property. There were actually 8 distinct fields that were used for different crops, and there was also a 9th area that was used both as a residence for the family who was operating and farming this property, but also as a service area for supporting the agricultural activities at the site. So I guess with that as an initial step or a little backdrop, Valerie, what might be the next thing we want to consider as part of this as part of this project if we're thinking about the application or the applicability of a bioavailability study?
Yeah, well, the first thing that's really important is whether or not the project focuses on human exposure to contaminated soil. This guidance document is specifically geared towards human exposures and not ecological concerns. And so I know as such we're presenting a case study that is a very simplified version. But the main important question to ask is if the project focus is on human exposure to contaminated soils.
Okay. Well, we do have you know, that condition here. It's a site that's being planned for redevelopment. Parts of the property are likely going to be used for recreational purposes, but large portions of the site may also be used for residential purposes as well. Right now, there is an expectation that about 70% of the property will be used for homes, with the remaining portions of the site being used for trails, green spaces, playgrounds, and that sort of activity. So we are looking at a situation in which we have direct human exposure potential to contaminated soil. And I guess, you know, with that, you know, we are in a condition where, you know, we are concerned about possible human exposures to the arsenic in soil. And, you know, with that, again, is another element here. You know, what might be the next thing we'd want to consider, Valerie, as we move forward in thinking about this potential opportunity to use this science as part of our evaluation strategy?
Yeah, the next question is about, does the project focus on soil ingestion? And really, this is talking a lot about not just the exposure to soil ingestion, but also is that what's driving the risk? And the reason that that is important is because we've seen this, Anita presented us this this equation previously, but how we're looking at this is the relative bioavailability term, or RBA, is applied only to the ingestion portion of the risk assessment. It's not applied to dermal, and it's not applied to inhalation, because all of the data that we're going to be presenting and the work that's been done is mainly focused on soil ingestion. So that is a critical question as we move forward. The other important thing to consider, especially with arsenic, is what the background concentration of arsenic in soils. This is a map showing the United States with some kind of a heat map, different color coding, and showing the basic general background concentration naturally occurring of arsenic in soils. And you can see that it ranges quite a bit, and for the most part, most of the background concentrations that you're going to see in soil are greater than the risk-based screening level. So here in this box, we have the US EPA and then also our California DTSC screening levels. And both of these are less than 1 mg/kg arsenic for a residential scenario. And this is already assuming a default RBA of 60%. Now, a little comment about the 60% default from US EPA. When EPA first discussed this idea of a default, we didn't have approved methods for looking at arsenic. Now, US EPA has their method that they recommend for looking at arsenic. In California, we have our own method as well. And so what US EPA's default says is that you should only use the 60% in the absence of ability to determine site-specific data. But now we've got some really nice in vitro methods, which we'll talk about as we move forward, which really makes it possible to go ahead and do these site-specific evaluations. But knowing your background concentrations in your soil is also really important. So what do you think, Kevin? Does this seem so far like this is going to be something that's going to work?
I do. So I guess what we've done at this point is we've gone ahead and collected soil samples from the different portions of the property. In addition to that, you know, per your suggestion, we've also looked at concentrations in soil in areas of the site that are just off of the property, areas that we think would have been unimpacted by any agricultural use. So we do get some sense of what the naturally occurring levels of arsenic in soil are at this property. And to basically simplify the results for us, Valerie. These are the concentrations that were observed on average within each of these individual units. And our risk assessor has gone ahead and provided us with some estimates of what the risks might be for residents or recreators who may come into contact with the soil using that default 60% relative bioavailability estimate. So as of right now, based upon these results, if we're going to move forward with the redevelopment project, we have a pretty good amount of material that we have to think about managing. We're at a point where about 65% of the soil might warrant removal, which is a pretty extensive amount of material. And so as a result, we have a somewhat significant environmental footprint to this redevelopment project. So I guess, I would be interested in talking more about how we might go about doing a site-specific assessment. You had mentioned the possibility of methods. I'm guessing is that something we might be able to take advantage of? What might be the next question we need to think about? Anyway, I'm in your hands.
I already alluded to it. You know, the question is there a method available? And this is important because this flow chart is used for all types of sites, not just arsenic. But, yeah, for when we talk about arsenic, we're lucky that we do have some great methods available. Historically, if you wanted to do this kind of analysis, you would have to use an animal model. The juvenile swine was for a long time kind of considered the gold standard. The juvenile swine intestinal tract is very similar to that of children, which is why it was used. But these were very expensive and time-consuming procedures. And now we are very lucky that we have a number of in vitro methods that are available and approved for use and applying to sites for arsenic. So it's important to know which method is the best use for your site, and that's important to talk to the regulatory agency to determine that as well. But both US EPA and California have in vitro methods that are available to use for making site-specific decisions. So we do have some methods available. The next question, though, so we've got the methods, and then the next question is, well, is the bioavailability assessment even going to affect your remedial decisions? Because if it's not going to change your decision-making process, then it's probably not worth the time, the effort, and the resources to go ahead and move forward with it. So this is a figure from our ITRC bioavailability and contaminated soils document, and this is really just meant to give you a general idea of when it might be appropriate to use bioavailability, when you're kind of going to get your most bang for your buck, if you will. But really, so we're looking at, if you're looking at a residential land reuse, if you're looking at total arsenic of 100 milligrams per kilogram, you probably have a pretty good chance of having, a positive impact from doing this kind of analysis, and it's going to be a positive impact. Versus if you're well over 1,000 milligrams per kilogram soil, even if that comes back at 1% bioavailable, you're still going to have to do some significant remediation to get a residential land reuse. So this figure is just kind of trying to show you, how likely it is that bioavailability analysis is going to make a difference for you on your site, given these specific parameters. So what do you think, Kevin?
Well, we went ahead and using that matrix, we've gone ahead and looked at those concentrations that I mentioned before that we observed on each of these individual areas relative to those matrices. And with regards to residential exposure, it does look like we have, maybe a fair to low chance of resulting in a refined risk assessment or a risk assessment less of uncertainty after conducting such a study that may not necessarily change our remedy decision. However, with regards to recreational exposure, it looks like we have a pretty decent chance of conducting a bioavailability assessment on a site-specific basis. And with that, potentially resulting in, a difference in our final remedy decision. So I think, based upon that, it's intriguing to think about conducting a site-specific study. What what might else we need to think about before perhaps making the decision to go ahead and leap forward and do such a study?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the big questions, do the benefits of the bioavailability assessment justify the cost? And so there's quite a few steps that are involved in conducting a cost-benefit analysis, you know, defining what kind of data needs you have, how many samples you're going to have to collect, what analysis you're going to have to do, estimating the bioavailability assessment cost, and of course the cost associated with doing the reports and all of that as well. And so is it going to be a cost benefit? So I think what we're going to do is going to go ahead and throw up a poll here and ask everybody how much you think an in vitro bioavailability study for this site would cost. Giving everybody a little bit. So it looks like it's most people are coming in around $20,000, and the next up is about $100,000. So yeah, I think that those are great thoughts. We do actually have a section in our guidance document that looks at the various costs associated with these different analyses that you would want to do if you're doing a site-specific bioavailability analysis. And you can see that, so the in vitro bioavailability IVBA for arsenic runs about $150 to $1,000 per sample, depending on depending on what lab you use and how many samples you have. And this is much cheaper in comparison to, like I said, you used to have to be able to use these animal studies, and there we were looking at $75,000 for a swine study for maybe only three soils being looked at. So we're definitely at a good place at this time to move forward with this kind of analysis in terms of it being affordable. So, yeah, what are you thinking, Kevin?
Yeah, that's excellent. I think we're going to go through the process of collecting samples from each of the units. If we do so, we're looking at about a $10,000 to $20,000 effort, which is relatively inexpensive, somewhat surprising to me. How inexpensive it would be for us to gather this data, have it analyzed, and give us some sense that, actually what the actual relative bioavailability of arsenic in soil might be at this particular site. So I'm feeling pretty good about potentially using this as part of our project. Is there anything else that we should first think about, or any last-minute questions we might need to navigate through before we truly decide to go ahead and pull the trigger?
Yeah, so there's a number of things. One is public acceptance. This is something where we're going in and we're going to be potentially raising remedial goals based off of the data. Even though this is a refinement of a risk assessment, and that's really important that we let the public know that, you want to make sure that you get that public buy-in so they don't feel like you're just trying to let a responsible party get away with leaving higher concentrations of arsenic and that you're not being protective of human health, because that's not the case at all. But you need to make sure you have that public acceptance. Regulatory constraints, you need to make sure, as I mentioned earlier, that you're using the method that's going to be accepted by the agency that's regulating the cleanup. And then there's all of the normal logistical and technical constraints that come with any kind of analysis in terms of collecting the samples and finding the laboratory and all of that. But once you've considered all of those things, then you're pretty much in really good shape to move forward.
Excellent. Okay, well, we've done that. We've gone ahead and we've collected the samples. We submitted them to the lab. And what we got back were a pretty decent range of IVBA estimates. So we've got a range that goes from about 31% to almost as high as 45%. And, an estimate of the average, essentially a conservative estimate of the average of those results is about 39%. So this is what I got from the lab, Valerie. Is this the value? Is this the number that I'm supposed to plug into my risk equation to modify my, my risk calculation? Or is there something else I should be using? Can I use this number directly?
Yeah, great question, Kevin. So this is where that in vivo in vitro correlation becomes really important. This is really the cornerstone of any in vitro analysis that you may use. We want to make sure when we're applying these to human health risk assessments that we are really using a value that is representative of what we would expect to see in vivo. And so all of these approved in vitro analyses for arsenic have gone through a study where they've been the same soils have been fed to the animals, and then we've looked at in vitro, and an IV-IVC has come up with. So in this case, when you have an IVBA of 39% as you presented, you would pop that into this equation, which somehow appears to be inverted on this slide. That's the first time I've noticed that. But anyways, if you pop that up, well, if you pop that in here, then that gives you a RBA result of 35%. And it's that 35% that you would then add into these equations. Now, you don't put 35, you put 0.35, because, again, RBA is something that's really in every risk equation that we have. It's just it's usually assumed to be 100% or unity, so 1. So you would put in 0.35 into this equation, and that's what you would use for your risk assessment.
Okay. So our we've had our risk assessor do that, swapping out that 60% estimate with the 35% RBA. And on the basis of these updated risk estimates, it has changed our outcome somewhat. So now we're down to about 25% of the site that may warrant some degree of management. So just by accounting for you know, actual site-specific relative bioavailability, it looks like we've significantly reduced the potential environmental footprint of this site redevelopment. So anyway, overall, I think it was a very positive help to us in getting this analysis performed in a way that's going to result in a better outcome for everyone. So overall, thank you, Valerie, for kind of helping me navigate through that, and appreciate your support. So Molly, we'll pass it back over to you for our question and answer session.
Yes, thank you, Kevin and Valerie. At this time, we will open the first question and answer portion of our training. So for those of you on the phone line that are interested in asking a question out loud, I will give you the opportunity to do so in just a moment. Remember that it is #6 to unmute your line. For anyone else, at any time you can type in your question through the Q&A area located in the bottom right corner of your screen. We will try to get through as many of your questions as we can. Just a reminder for those of you that are interested in receiving certificates of completion, they will be available upon the completion of the feedback form. Once you complete the form and click the box to certify you participated, that certificate will be provided to you. So let's go to our phone lines. If you would like to ask a question out loud, this is your opportunity to do so. Once again, it's #6 to unmute. We'll wait another few moments for any questions over the phone, but remember that you can also type your questions in the Q&A area located in the bottom right-hand corner of your screen. Okay, so we did get a few questions through the Q&A portal. The first question is, in regard to cost and assessment, how many samples were required from each area?
So that's not something that we cover specifically in this guidance document. It really comes down to site-specific characteristics and characterizing your site. It might be if you have a large site with different sources of arsenic, then you might choose your sampling units differently. So these are all kinds of things that are covered by other ITRC guidance documents, such as the incremental sampling methodology and other site characterization documents, but they're not covered specifically here. It would be just kind of the same decisions you would make for a regular site assessment. But really, in general, you want to make sure that you have the full range of arsenic concentrations represented in your bioavailability studies so that you make sure that you don't see any differences, and you'd want to evaluate different sources separately as well.
Yeah, and this is Kevin. I want to echo what Mallory just said. I think you can approach characterizing relative bioavailability much like you would approach characterizing other elements to your investigation for risk assessment purposes. So making sure you have enough data to feel comfortable that you captured variability, that you have enough information that you can assess uncertainty in your estimates. But overall, even though the scenario that we walked through is completely hypothetical and basically made up, as a way of navigating and showing how you might go through the process, I think you can keep a general mindset that is all about are essentially consistent with how you would go about characterizing other aspects of your site in order to support a risk assessment.
Thanks, Kevin and Valerie. We have another question which asks, what about post-remedial changes in bioavailability, for example, irrigation or fertilizer?
So yeah, we haven't seen evidence of irrigation having a big impact on bioavailability moving forward. There's some possibility with various fertilizers, that could impact arsenic bioavailability. And so that's a really important consideration as you move forward in terms of maybe doing a pilot study if you're concerned that that's something that you think will change. It doesn't typically change drastically. That's not something that I have seen, but it is certainly an important consideration. And if you're worried about the type of fertilizer that may be used on your site in the future, then there might be worthy to do a pilot study to see if that has any impact on the arsenic bioavailability, or even put some kind of land use controls or five-year review type scenario in there to go and double check as you move forward.
Thanks, Valerie. Another question, does every state have a background arsenic level?
So I think this is really a state-dependent thing, because also here in California, we don't have a single background number, because there is no single background number in California. You can be in some areas and the background can be even non-detect for arsenic, and then you get into some of these mining areas and we have really high arsenic background, over 100 milligrams per kilogram, and so it's really difficult to have a single number unless you have very consistent mineralogy throughout your entire state. Some states do have set backgrounds, and they say this is the background, and then anything above this is what you would need to evaluate, and anything below this is clear. Like I said, in California, we do not. My recommendation is if you're doing a site-specific bioavailability study, that you would also want to determine your site-specific background, because you'd want to be able to compare the two as you move forward, and you'd want to be able to evaluate the bioavailability of that background as well. So usually we can do that by finding either a undisturbed area on the site that hasn't had any kind of impact, or sometimes we take samples at a deeper depth to where we don't think there's been any kind of impact, but of course that relies on the mineralogy being similar, on the surface as well as at depth. Or sometimes there may be a neighboring site that has the similar mineralogy but hasn't been impacted by any kind of activities, and that would be another place that you could get your background information.
And just one last thing to note, there actually is an ITRC team right now that's just starting that is going to be working on the problems, or at least the challenges, of accounting for a background in soil when conducting a risk assessment. So while there is content in this guidance with specific regards to the relative bioavailability in background soil and how that might fit and play in your risk assessment, that future team's guidance might also be something to kind of keep an eye out for as it begins to get developed over the next couple of years.
Great, thanks. We have time for one more question, and this was asked a little earlier during the training session, but how were the size and number of sampling units determined?
So again, I think that goes back to the question that we had earlier, where we don't specifically go into that in this document. You would again want to look at your site characterization, look at what you know about mineralogy, what you know about sources, and then make decisions to move forward from there, and then make sure that you would have the full suite of the full range of arsenic concentrations that you have on your site included in your in vitro analysis.
Great. Well, thanks to everyone for submitting your questions. We are now going to move on to the second portion of our training. I will move on to slide 72 and let Jeff and Barry take over.
Great. Thanks, Molly. So, yeah, now we're going to talk about a lead site and lead case study and walk through that process. So the case studies presented a series of meetings between regulator and consultant. I'm sure we can all identify with the exciting meeting that we see here on the right. So I'm going to play the role of the regulator, and Barry Selka with Jacobs will take the consultant role. And we're going to ask some poll questions during this case study, and we'd like the audience to feel as they are team members and answer those questions for us. So a little site background information. It's a historic lead mining district, so the contaminant source is all lead-containing leftover ore following processing. Over time, some housing has been built into the tailings area, and there's going to be future land use plans are for more residential and more commercial development. So here's some photos of the site. Aerial photo on the left from 1943. You can see the tailings there in the center. It's about a 3-acre parcel total. Mining ceased back in the 60s, and the tailings are 1 to 2 feet thick. So now you're seeing an aerial photo of the residential area that we're focused on. It's a 3-acre site with 10 properties. All of them are kind of average size lots for residential development of that time, 1/3 acre or smaller. Some of them have play areas, some have gardens, but each parcel has distinct front, back, and two side yards. So those will all be sampling in those areas. So we had the consultant go and do some initial sampling for total lead in these 10 properties, and you can see where we took the samples on the map. The discrete samples are coming out of the play areas and the gardens, and the composite samples are coming out of the 4 yard areas for each parcel. So the data set that we have to work with, looking at total lead values, are 10 properties, the 4 yards with sample composite samples. So we have 40 composite samples. There were 5 properties with gardens. We wanted 2 sample discrete samples from those, so 10 of those. And we've got 5 properties with play areas with 1 discrete sample. So we've got a pretty decent data set to work with. The total lead concentrations we found were 380 to about 1,300 parts per million and a mean of about 850. We know the background for this area is 30 parts per million, so we're at minimum an order of magnitude above background. So clearly something's going to need to be done. Unsurprising for a former mine area, the soil type is a well-graded gravel covered with a thin layer of organic material. So when we lay the data back on top of our parcel map, you can get a sense of you know how it's falling. If you look at the total lead values using the state screening levels of 400 parts per million, which is the EPA recommendation, almost the entire site is going to require remediation. And while we know it's 400 now, chances are it's going to be headed to 200 with the recent release of new blood lead data from CDC. So if we're looking at default characteristics, default sampling, we're going to have to, really dig up a lot of material. 3-acre site, 1 to 2 feet depth, about 5,000 cubic yards, and we're going to have a pretty high cost. So using bioavailability might be a good option. So I'd like Barry to jump in here and kind of walk us through how that might work in this scenario.
Sure, yeah, thanks. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. All right. So, based on the data that we have for our site, we've developed a ballpark estimate for excavation and transportation and disposal costs pretty much based on the soil volume that would need to be removed since it exceeds the default cleanup level. But at this point, we could either excavate all the properties or we could do a site-specific bioavailability study with the hope of reducing the volume of soil that needs to be remediated. So that's what we'd like to talk about today, you know, the viability of doing a bioavailability study for the site. So at this point, we're considering doing a site-specific bioavailability study so that we can develop site-specific soil cleanup levels that take the site's bioavailability into account. So we're using this decision flow chart from the new ITRC bioavailability guidance document to help us think through it and help us figure out if it's worth doing. So this flowchart here from the document shows the things that we're considering, and I'm going to talk through the steps of the flowchart in relation to our site. Well, according to the flowchart, we need to determine if there is a bioavailability method available for the chemical that's an issue at the site. And, of course, in our case, this is lead. Well, EPA recently published guidance on the lab method to use for IVBA testing, and we could use that. And this photo here shows the apparatus that's used when performing this EPA lab method. According to the method, you know, we can use an in vitro lead method rather than an animal study, since validated methods show good in vitro, in vivo correlation on waste materials that are similar to the type at our site, which are from mining. And the concentrations in soil at our site are within the range of concentrations that were tested using the IVBA according to the EPA method documentation. So we looked at the lead concentrations that were detected at our site using our existing data set for total lead. And our concentrations in soil are about 400 to 1,320 parts per million. And so based on this figure from the ITRC guidance document, our site concentrations are within the range of concentrations where bioavailability testing is likely to be helpful for our site. So the next step of the flowchart really is determining if the potential benefits of conducting a bioavailability study justify the cost of doing it. So we started to look at the cost to do a bioavailability study, and we have to include not just the cost of sample collection and lab analysis, but we also have to include costs associated with other components of a well-documented study, such as preparing a work plan, data validation, evaluating the data, collecting and calculating the site-specific cleanup levels, and then coordinating with stakeholders throughout the whole process, you know, planning and reporting stages. So we come to a point where, you know, we need to finish estimating the cost of the bioavailability study, but we need to know how many samples we have to collect, since the number of samples directly affects the cost of doing the field work, the cost of data validation, the cost of, you know, the calculations that we would need to do. So we really need to know how many samples is your agency going to require that we collect for bioavailability testing for the site. So, Jeff, what do you think?
We're seeing now, you know, the majority are saying two discrete samples per property. As it turns out, there's actually no exact right or wrong answer. It's going to depend on the agency you're working with. Just make sure you clarify those details with that agency before you go out and do the sampling work. So previous trainings, we've actually found that 10 incremental samples across 3 acres was the most common answer. However, there's actually some guidance out there on how many samples that need to be collected. So following the EPA guidance document put out in 2015 is you need a minimum of 2 composites made up of 30 increments. And this is coming through the incremental sampling methodology that's been put out by EPA. That's really good at reducing type 1 error rate between your samples. One thing you got to be careful with in doing this type of sampling is that you get equal representation from all your increments, both volume and depth of the sample collected. You're going to collect each sample in triplicate. And luckily, there's an entire ITRC guidance document out on this as well. Also, great resource for you to go to learn about this type of sampling methodology. So then looking back at our site, so where would we need to be collecting these IVBA samples? So according to the incremental sampling methodology, and because the soil type is homogeneous and it has a single source of lead, we can actually view the entire 10-acre parcel as a single decision unit. And that's a term that incremental sampling uses in deciding where sampling needs to be done. So we could use the entire property, but we know that we need to have at least two decision units. So we split the parcel up into two units, each having lead in similar concentration ranges. Now, one thing that's a little different with the kind of sampling that you do for incremental sampling and then doing bioavailability sampling is you actually sieve the soil for the bioavailability testing to 150 microns. Now, the standard separation for soil versus gravel is at 2 millimeters. So this is much, much, much finer. Fortunately, you don't have to sieve much. The bioavailability test itself only requires 1 gram of this 150 micron soil. So you still have to collect the soil, but you don't have to spend all that. You don't have to sieve all of it. The reason we use 150 micron soil is that that's the soil that has been found to be most likely to stick to your hands and objects. And if it sticks to your hands, it then gets in your mouth. And people, that's the size fraction that people ingest. We know that the small particle size may lead to lead enrichment. Again, just small particle size, more bioavailable. So essentially, it's protective in sieving it to this small particle size. So to recap, if we didn't do the bioavailability study, just based on the sampling that's already been done looking at total lead, we're going to need to excavate about 5,000 cubic yards and about $700,000 and rip up the homeowner's landscaping. But if we do the bioavailability study, and if everything goes as we might hope, we might end up with a relative bioavailability of as low as 20 to 30%, which is not unheard of and actually almost to be expected in some of these lead sulfide minerals that you usually find at mining sites. You know, if it's really the lead is only 20 to 30% bioavailable, we may not have to excavate anything. We're estimating about $30,000 to do the study. But the remedy will be just as protective as digging up everyone's yard. So, of course, you always have to, you know, take into account these outside considerations. The first and foremost one, of course, is public acceptance. You know, lead is a pretty hot-button issue these days, lead in drinking water and lead in soil. And so residents probably in this scenario have been hearing about that 400 part per million cleanup level. So when you go back and say, oh, we may not have to excavate anything and we're going to leave it at 400, you're going to have to really be able to explain why. We would suggest preparing fact sheets to be able to hand out and really walk your community stakeholders with. I work for Cooperative Extension, and the technical documents that we produce for public consumption, we write at the eighth grade level. And it actually makes a big difference in being able to get your ideas across to the general public. Again, there could be regulatory constraints. In this case, maybe there's a health department that's just not willing to go along with bioavailability assessment in the risk assessment process. Logistical constraints and also technical constraints. One of these frequent technical constraints is co-located contaminants. Maybe this ore body also had arsenic, or maybe it also had some chromium, and you'd have to take that into account. So as we're moving towards our next meeting, we're going to move forward with using EPA method 1340. The site's going to be divided into two decision units with one incremental sample from each collected in triplicate, and then we'll use our data to do a site-specific soil cleanup analysis. So here we are back in our conference room. Work plan is submitted and done. The bioavailability study is done. Got our lab results back, and now we're ready to hear from Barry about what the results are telling us.
All right, Jeff, well, you know, thanks for having time to meet back with us today. We got the bioavailability data back from the lab, and so today we'll be talking about the results that we found. So first of all, the lab reported the results to us in terms of IVBA, and so we had to go through a few calculations to put the lab results into a form that we could use in the lead models to calculate the site-specific cleanup levels. So first, we had to calculate the relative oral bioavailability. The documentation for EPA method 1340 gives us an equation for calculating the RBA from the IVBA results, and so we use that equation. And, you know, as you know from before, you know, we have triplicate incremental sample results for each decision unit, and the lab provided the IVBA, and we calculated the RBA for each sample using the equation in the lab method. The equation uses values, you know, not percentages, when calculating the relative oral bioavailability. So the results range, in our case, from 0.14 to 0.17. So when we express it as a percentage, the RBA ranges from 14 to 17%. So we saw close agreement between the triplicate results and the two decision units. So, you know, the residential lead model, the IEBK model, it uses the absolute bioavailability rather than the RBA. So we also had to calculate that too, since we have to have the appropriate value to put in the IEBK model. So we calculated the ABA for each of the samples, and our ABA results range from 7 to 8.5% for the incremental samples. So we have close agreement in the ABA for the samples. Now, since we saw close agreement between the six ABA results, and because the lead model uses an arithmetic mean lead concentration as an input parameter, we could use the average of the six measured values, which is 15% relative oral bioavailability, you know, to represent both decision units, or we could use the higher 95% upper confidence limit on the mean between the two triplicate samples, or we could use the maximum RBA for the six samples, and so what will be acceptable to the agency?
So it looks like the team has voted, and they're selecting the higher 95% upper confidence limit on the mean of the two triplicate samples, and that's actually what we would recommend as well. Again, there's no absolute right or wrong answer, just to make sure you work out those details with the regulatory agency beforehand.
Okay, well, we thought that might be the case, and so that's the value that we used in our draft calculations that we're presenting today to represent both decision units in the lead models. So that's good we were able to predict that. Okay, well, lead exposures are assessed with pharmacokinetic models, and the IUBK model is used for residential exposures, and the adult lead methodology, which is called the ALM, that's used for non-residential exposures. So these models have a default relative oral bioavailability of 60% from soil and dust already embedded in them, and we replaced that default RBA with the site-specific RBA in the model. Now, Section 9 of the ITRC bioavailability document, it shows the detailed steps on how to incorporate the site-specific RBA into the lead models. And so that's what we followed for doing these calculations. Now, to calculate the site-specific soil cleanup level, we need to know the target blood lead level to use for the models. And EPA recently published a document indicating that adverse health effects occur below a blood lead level of 10 micrograms per deciliter, but they didn't recommend a specific target blood lead level to use. So for these draft cleanup level calculations that I'm going to show you today, we used a target blood lead level of 5 micrograms per deciliter. So we ran the IUBK model with the site-specific RBA data and a target blood lead level of 5 micrograms per deciliter, and we calculated a site-specific residential cleanup level of 580 parts per million. So you can see that the site-specific bioavailability study resulted in a site-specific cleanup level that's higher than the default state cleanup level that we had been using that had been based on the RBA of 60%. But, you know, remember our site-specific cleanup level, even though it's higher than the state default level, it still remains protective of children. So if the area remains residential, some areas will need to be remediated, but it's a smaller area than the original area that was based on that default RBA of 60%. of course, you know, we talked earlier about how this area is also being considered for future commercial land use. So we ran the non-residential LED model, the ALM model. We ran that with the site-specific RBA and also a target blood lead level of 5 micrograms per deciliter, and that gave us a site-specific commercial cleanup level of 3,800 parts per million. So, you know, the site-specific cleanup level for commercial land use is higher than the default state cleanup level of 800 that was based on the default RBA of 60%. But again, our site-specific level still remains protective of receptors. And so based on the site-specific commercial soil cleanup level, no lead concentrations at the site exceed that site-specific level, so no remediation would be needed. But we assume that institutional controls would still be needed to prevent certain types of commercial land use, such as a daycare facility.
Thanks, Mary. This is really great information and provides us some really good options for moving forward with this parcel. So it looks like the study is going to has reduced the uncertainty in the site risk and risk-based cleanup. It's going to eliminate disruption of the residents' lives. It's going to mitigate the remediation risks, such as the traffic tree damage. Won't make them live on a moonscape for a couple of years so their landscaping regrows. And it's really going to cut down on remedial action costs. It's also still going to be protective of human health, and it's given us flexibility. And it really showed us that stakeholder outreach was important throughout the whole process to be able to bring people along, since some parts of this process can be a little subtle to understand. And now I'm going to turn it back over to Anita Meyer with the U.S. Army Corps, who's going to talk about PAHs.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Barry. Okay, so I'm going to talk about PAHs, and relative bioavailability studies of PAHs isn't quite as mature as what you just saw demonstrated for arsenic and lead, because there is no IVIC in vitro method available yet, although they're being worked on for PAHs. But given that these are rather common contaminants, and methods are currently under development, we thought it was important to include them in the ITRC document. So PAHs are polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. There's over 10,000 individual chemicals out there. That doesn't mean they're all in commerce, but there are many, many PAHs. There are 7 PAHs that are considered carcinogenic. There are 4 rings, 5 rings, and 6 rings and under this category, and you can see the list of those 7 carcinogenic PAHs. In the future, we may see this list grow to a longer list. It may grow to a list of 20. We'll see what the future holds and what EPA decides to finalize on that. There's data regarding their lipophilicity. They have low water solubility and low vapor pressure, although there are varying degrees of solubility. So sources of PAH in soil. There are PAHs that are naturally occurring, can happen from forest fires, grass fires, you know, natural things that occur, volcanic eruptions and oil, natural oil. There's industrial sources of PAHs. Manufactured gas plants, foundries, wood treating plants, refineries. And over here, we have a list here of the different types of PAH-bearing materials that might occur at these different sources. And then there's also non-industrial sources. Skeet targets is a source. They're held together. Skeet targets are held together with coal tar pitch, and those contain PAHs. Open burning, fire training areas may have PAHs, landfills, incinerators, and we may have emissions from truck emissions, auto emissions, and fires. And this is from, this is a nice table, and it is from Environmental Science and Technology. There's lots of different sources of PAHs in soil, and those sources may influence their relative bioavailability. So these pHs are among the most commonly seen chemicals of concern at contaminated sites. There are several of them that are known carcinogens, and they are commonly emitted from industrial sources and can be at contaminated sites. So the current regulatory default right now is to assume that they are 100% bioavailable. And that assumes that pHs from soil would be just as available as food spiked with pHs. So a pretty heavy bioavailability there. And we're beginning to conduct studies now to see that maybe that bioavailability is far less than that. And here's a summary of some of these studies. This was compiled in 2017, and over the years, there have been over 60 studies performed about bioavailability and pHs, and you can see that the number has increased over the years. So we had, some that were primarily in vivo studies, but now we're getting more studies performed to look at in vitro methods that, someday maybe we'll be able to correlate in vitro to in vivo methods. So the primary factor that is being elucidated through these studies and is what is controlling the binding? What is the factor of concern that influences their bioavailability? But there's still no consensus yet on in vitro or in vivo methods, which are the best to use, still being studied. So part of the reason that we don't have any solid answers yet on the best studies for pHs for bioavailability is because it's way more difficult to study than metals. And the reason is metals aren't metabolized. They aren't broken down. You can measure the lead that you feed an animal, and you can measure that same lead when it comes out. But pHs and other organic substances are metabolized after they are ingested by an animal or by a human. So, and also another factor besides metabolism is they occur as chemical mixtures. Most always you will see pHs occurring as a mixture. And also the analytical cost. The cost to analyze lead or arsenic might be $10 for a sample, whereas for pHs, it's 10 times higher than that. So they're not cheap studies to perform. But one of the main problems that kind of confounds the evaluation of pHs is its metabolism. Once you ingest pHs and it's absorbed into your system, it's metabolized in the liver. It can be metabolized at the target tissue after it goes into the bloodstream. It can be metabolized by the microbial flora in our GI tract. And there's multiple metabolites. So depending on the pH of concern, you have to figure out which metabolite you want to study in your bioavailability study, and then confound that with the chemical mixture. So you may have many different metabolites for a given pH, but then you may have many different pHs in your mixture. So it gets complicated fast. Another confounding factor is that once the pHs are metabolized in the liver, they can go back and be reabsorbed through the GI tract. And so you have these cyclings of pHs, and it's hard to determine at which point you need to take your measurement. So it gets complicated, but we're making headway on that. So some of the key considerations, and this is addressed in the bioavailability ITRC document, is some of the key considerations that are discussed are here on this slide from the ITRC document. We discuss determining the appropriate soil particle size, having comparison groups that are relevant, having an understanding of the pharmacokinetics. Pharmacokinetics is basically how a chemical moves throughout the body, which compartments it goes to at which time and what metabolite it might be in those different compartments. You need to have a way to measure the parent compound and metabolites. You need to have to know which metabolites you want to study. Number of subjects is always important. You need to determine the relevant concentrations and doses for performing the bioavailability study and you need to be able to demonstrate a full range of bioavailability. So you have to have kind of a scoping study first to determine the relevant concentrations to start with in your actual bioavailability study. And need to determine whether you're going to do an average versus individual subject measurements, average is better, and then consider mass balance during your experiment. All those are factors that have to be considered in the study design. And those are just, you know, that's discussed in the BCS document. Some more considerations, that we have here. Sources, toxicity, we discuss factors influencing RBA in soils. We have a discussion of in vitro and in vivo methods, a summary of the research conducted. Dermal absorption can be a factor for some PAHs, and it should not be ignored, especially if it is an exposure route of concern at your site. So that needs to be considered when you're setting up your study. You have to ask the question, do I need to consider dermal absorption? Is that a factor that's going to influence the results of my risk assessment? And is that an uncertainty that I want to reduce in my assessment? So that's something that should not be ignored, especially for benzoate-pyrene. And in the BCS document, we have a case study that is a skeet target fragment site. It was an old skeet shooting range that was on a military facility, and we did a bioavailability study of PAHs to determine how much of the PAHs from those skeet target fragments would be bioavailable. And that was a site that was in Texas and accepted by those regulators, and that case study is included in the document. So you can see how a study was performed and some of the factors that went into it. So what we know about PAHs from soil, what we know so far, is that the factor that dominates partitioning in vitro and vivo is the source of soil. Some sources have the source of the PAHs in the soil is what dominates. Some sources have higher RBA and some have lower. Lower is if your source of PAHs is from soot or skeet, those skeet target fragments as I was talking about, or pitch, there's lower relative bioavailability and higher. PAHs are going to more readily come out of fuel oil or an apple. And soil characteristics are less important for controlling relative bioavailability. Peat and clay content aren't as important as that source, and I'm going to show you a graphic that illustrates that nicely. And the addition of charcoal to soil can reduce RBA, and I've already mentioned the dermal exposure pathway can be important. So there's more work to be done to understand the factors that control bioavailability of PAHs from soil, but we have a lot of research still ongoing. So this is a graphic that I wanted to walk through that illustrates some of the soil chemical interactions that affect RBA. And let's pretend that this graphic here in the middle, these blobs, are our soil. This is a pile of soil, and this is kind of a magnification of that soil. So here we have different sources of PAHs. We have soot and pitch and fuel oil. And if you look here on the soot, for example, we have it's dominated by slowly desorbing PAHs. So in other words, it's not going to be as bioavailable because they desorb slowly from the soot. And it's mixed in here with other components of the soil, natural organic matter, and there may be some of the some PAHs that may be influenced by that, but not so much. It's more influenced by soot. And mineral phase is another factor that can influence the relative bioavailability, but mainly the influence is from the source. And you can see a pitch, and we have char as another source, and fuel oil, and humate. Oh, humate, that's a component of the soil. That's in some of the natural organic matter. So this demonstrates the purpose of this graphic is that absorption onto humic material and to peat is not so great. It's more so just coming right off of the source of the PAH and not absorbing back on to other factors, to other components of the soil. So I'm going to turn it over. We've completed the discussion of PAHs, and I'm going to turn it over to Shanna and to Valerie next.
Yeah, hi, this is Valerie. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Hello? Okay, great. Sorry. Yeah, thanks so much. So I'm going to just go through the final steps about, you know, now you've gotten this training, and now what are your next steps in terms of going forward and applying this kind of evaluation to your sites? I want to walk you through some of the resources that we have available. This is the front page, if you will, of our online document. This is the first thing that you'll come to when you go to the guidance document. And then over on the left, you'll see this navigation pane, and you can choose any topic that you are interested in looking at. You don't have to look at them in order, which is one of the nice things about the online, but I'm going to go through the different steps, the different chapters. So first, Chapter 1 has all the definitions and theory. It talks a lot about bioavailability, bioaccessibility. There's all these interchangeable terms, and so interchangeable, but lots of different terms that are new, and so it really goes into those details. Then we have a chapter on the regulatory background, and this includes the existing guidance and then state acceptance. We mentioned early on that when we were first doing this evaluation, we did a poll of the different state risk assessors to see how many states were actively using bioavailability at the time, and the results of that are included in this section. So that might be a good place to look to see if you're not sure whether or not your state is currently using this. Then we have a chapter on technical background. This is all the soil science and mineralogy, what different factors impact bioavailability, what can make bioavailability go up or down. Then we have the decision process. So that's that decision tree that we talked about in the case studies that we worked through, that cost-benefit analysis, all of that information about how you would actually walk through making decisions on your site. And then there's a chapter on methodology. This has the various in vivo methods as well as in vitro methods, and then the importance of that in vivo, in vitro correlation, how those studies are done and how those are used in risk assessment. We have our chemical-specific chapters, just like mirrored in our training today. We have chapters on lead, arsenic, and PAHs, and that dives into deeper details about each of those different chemicals. We have a chapter on risk assessment, so how we would use the results from these analyses, from these studies in our risk assessment. And then we have a stakeholder perspective. So this talks a lot about engagement, outreach, communication, how you really communicate what you're doing to the public and to the various stakeholders so that everyone feels confident that what we're doing is appropriate and health protective. And then finally, there's a case study section, and this is just the top call or top row from that, and it shows you can pick on a case study, this list of what contaminant is of concern, the case study covers, what kind of soil type was there, what was the source, and then what state it was. So you can go to this table and see if there's a site that is similar to yours, and then maybe you could get some idea of how bioavailability was measured and then applied to risk assessment for those particular sites. This is a figure that's also from our guidance that is talking about a little bit of how the distribution of contamination on your site can really impact how much you have to clean up of the site. That's true regardless of if you're looking at bioavailability or not. But what this is showing is two sites, site A and site B. Both have the same maximum concentration of 1,000 milligrams per kilogram, or maximum of 2,000 milligrams per kilogram, I'm sorry, and the cleanup level of 100 milligrams per kilogram based off of 100% RBA. And so this is just showing you that if you this is kind of something you would look at before you did your analysis, right? So how would it make an impact to your site? So if you're going to guess that you would have 20% bioavailability on your site when you come out, or what happens if that's your result? How would that impact your site? If you have a log normal distributed site, like site A, then you can see that, you know, it's about 10% of your 10% of the volume there that would need to the above the 500 milligrams per kilogram and therefore would require cleanup, versus with something like site B where you have a more linear distribution, 75% of the total volume would still need to be remediated at that same 20% bioavailability. So it's just something to kind of give you an idea as to how you approach this and what kind of impacts to your cleanups the results of your bioavailability study may have. And this is a very simplified version, kind of sharing the same thing. So here we've got this completely fictitious site, and we're looking at a relative bioavailability of 100%. This is a site with a core of 100 milligrams per kilogram, and then the contamination gets lighter as you move out. And so using 100% bioavailability, the cleanup risk, the cleanup goal using 1 times 10 to the minus 6 risk would be 10 milligrams per kilogram. And in that scenario, you're going to have to clean up all of this, and that's going to be, you know, fictitiously 10 truckloads full of soil that are going to need to be removed, go through the community, transported to landfill, whether it's a hazardous waste or not. And so that's quite a bit of environmental impact to clean up that site. Now, let's say we applied the US EPA default of 60% to this site. Well, now, with still having that same target risk of a 1 times 10 to the minus 6 risk, now our cleanup goal becomes 17 milligrams per kilogram. And you can see that this changes, that now the two hot spots in the area are going to be cleaned up, but you have less soil. Now this outer area that has 15 milligrams per kilogram, that is acceptable to remain on site. And so you reduce the number of truckloads that would of soil that would need to be removed and trucked out and transported to a landfill. And then finally, let's say you go and do a site-specific evaluation and you figure out that your relative bioavailability is 25%. Now, still based off of a 1 times 10 to the minus 6 target risk, you're looking at a cleanup goal of 40 milligrams per kilogram, and now you're only having to do remediation of that middle highest hot spot concentration in the middle of your site. You greatly reduce the number of trucks that are going to of soil that are going to need to be removed and transported through the community, and that whole environmental impact that comes with that. So that's just kind of a really nice simplified cartoon that shows the kind of impacts that this kind of evaluation can have. Finally, I do want to show you this review checklist. This is part of the ITRC guidance online, and it takes you through a whole checklist of the questions that you're going to want to ask as you move forward, and it will really help guide you through your study. So we suggest you print this out when you're going to have a study and you work your way through it to make sure that you're covering all your bases and you don't forget anything. And then I just want to go over some site-specific RBA evaluation take-home messages from this analysis. First of all, the goal is really to decrease the uncertainty of risk assessment. All we're doing is refining the risk assessment with some scientific information. And you know, we do this all the time in risk assessment. We refine our risk assessments all the time on site-specific information. And so that's what we're doing here. And then we're still maintaining that same target risk level. So if your target risk is a 1 times 10 to the minus 6 risk, which is the point of departure for risk management decisions, you know, that's usually where everybody says we're good to go and there's no further action needed, we're still maintaining the same risk level. That's not changing when we make these adjustments. It can help you improve remedial decision making because if you're now knowing that your bioavailability is lowered, you don't have to clean up as much, then that certainly guides where how you spend your money and how you're available to spend that for remediation, which can often lead to a significant savings of the resources available for remediation. If you've got to clean up significantly less site, as you could see, remember from our arsenic case study, it was a drastic reduction in cost associated with doing the bioavailability study and how that changed those remedial decisions. This is a very multidisciplinary process, and so you really need to involve your whole team early. And when I say that, I mean, so from the regulatory standpoint, you've got project managers, geologists, risk assessors, toxicologists. You want to make sure that you're collecting the right information, that everybody is in agreement as to what those decision units are, how many samples need to be collected, which samples need to be evaluated, what is the appropriate method to use. And then consultants, obviously, they need to be on board with what the regulatory agency is recommending, and then also in how they're going to do the collections. All of, and again, the stakeholders, responsible parties, and the public need to understand why it is that we're doing this kind of evaluation and really be, and really know that we're really just refining the risk assessment and that we're not sacrificing human health for the sake of saving money. And I think that's something that people often think is maybe the case here, and it's really important that we message it so that they know it's not. And that's all we've got. I think we're going to have some question and answers now again. Molly?
Valerie, at this time, we will have another question and answer period. Remember, you can type in your question in the Q&A area located in the bottom right corner of your screen. Before we get to the questions, I'm going to pull up a couple of poll questions for everyone to fill out. We would like to hear back from you today, so please be sure to fill out our online feedback form that's linked on this last slide. You can also access the feedback form by clicking Feedback in the related link section and then clicking Browse To. Filling out the feedback form and certifying that you participated will allow you to receive a certificate of completion. So we're going to move on to a few questions. For anyone who wants to ask a question through our phone line, remember that it's #6 to unmute. For everyone else, you can type in your question through the Q&A pod in the bottom right corner of your screen. Okay, we'll wait a few more moments for any questions over the phone. So remember, again, you can type your questions in the Q&A area located in the bottom right-hand corner of your screen. Okay, so we do have a question. Is there a lead action level? If exceeded, an area must be remediated.
So that's really going to depend on your state that you're in. I know US EPA has different standard recommendations than, say, I'm in California. So for us, our screening level for residential is an 80 milligram per kilogram screening level. That's based off of the concentration in soil that is expected to increase blood lead by one microgram per deciliter, but I know that US EPA's numbers are quite a bit higher. I think it's 400 for residential. I will say in California, it's not a bright line action level in terms of, it's not that if you have anything that exceeds 80 milligrams per kilogram, it automatically requires cleanup. What it is that for us here in California, you would look at a 95 UCL of your site, and that would be the number that you would want to be close to, that 80 milligrams per kilogram. So there's a little bit of wiggle room in there. So it's not a bright line action level. I would say the one place we do in California, oftentimes if we're hitting that the hazardous waste criteria of 1,000 milligrams per kilogram, then usually that's something that we're going to say we want to get removed because it's reached that level. So that's the only real immediate action level that I would say we will sometimes evaluate here in California. I don't know if anybody else wants to add to that.
Okay.
Yeah, this is Barry. This is Barry. I'll just add that EPA typically uses the 400 parts per million screening level for residential sites and 800 parts per million for commercial industrial sites, but they do also allow site-specific bioavailability to be taken into consideration when developing site-specific cleanup levels. So those lead levels aren't necessarily used as action levels by EPA now. They really are looking at a site-specific bioavailability if it's available.
Okay, great, thank you. Our next question is, how about leaching to groundwater? If leaving the soil on site is not a problem based on site-specific bioavailability, do we need to further evaluate soil migration to groundwater level?
I can comment on that. Generally, you know, you're still going to need to make all of those same kind of evaluations that that you would for any site, whether or not you had those adjustments for bioavailability. So you'd want to look at all of the transport mechanisms, and so that would be important if you're concerned about migration into groundwater. If you've got really shallow groundwater, really high concentrations, then you would absolutely still want to look at that, and that would be something that would be separate from the bioavailability. As what we're presenting here is really just strictly looking at ingestion of soils, and then that's the term that we're adjusting in the risk assessment for the RBA, but you would still want to do all of your other typical analyses of a site.
Great, thank you. We have another question. For PAH bioavailability studies, what role does induction of metabolic enzymes play?
For assessing bioavailability, in the body, the metabolism of the pHs is going to be greater if certain enzymes are induced, but that's not really a factor that goes into consideration when we're doing a bioavailability study for PAHs. It's just something that is part of the variability of each individual animal. But, you know, when we're designing the study, we're going to have purchase animals from a reliable vendor to ensure that they're fairly constant and we aren't going to have variations like that. I hope that answers the question.
Great, thank you. Another question. For the areas to be remediated, would you have to remove the houses?
This is Anita. I can take a shot at answering that. With the Corps of Engineers, we've done remediation on several different housing areas, and no, we don't remove the houses. We will dig as close to the foundation as possible, and if that removes, you know, all the contaminated soil, that's great, but there's been some instances where we had to go to depth close to the foundation, and so we stabilize the houses with peerings and other features that we brought onto the site to stabilize the house so that we could remove the contaminated soil, and those were very successful.
This is Barry. I just want to mention that I've been involved in projects with large residential neighborhood cleanups working with EPA, and it's the same as Anita said, in terms of leaving the house where it is and just going as close to the house as possible. So I just want to mention that that's also the approach when US EPA is involved.
Thank you. We have a follow-up question. For housing sites that are not remediated, are homeowners provided with best practices to minimize exposure pathways?
This is Barry. So when you're asking about housing sites not remediated, I'm not sure if that means under the house or if that means a property that is not remediated. So I'll just speak to a property that is not remediated. And yes, I have seen homeowners be given fact sheets on how to minimize exposure to impacted soil and good housekeeping approaches and good cleanliness approaches to minimizing exposure. So if that's what was meant, then I've seen that.
Okay, great. We have another question. Was it ever more cost effective to buy the property rather than remediate to residential?
This is Anita. I'll take a shot at answering it. We have seen that play out on some of our projects with the Corps of Engineers. However, you know, those are not choices that we wanted to force upon the property owner. Those are, you know, discussions that occurred between the government and the property owner. And to tell you the truth, I think there might have been a couple instances where, you know, that could have happened, but you know, where the government bought the property, that I really can't say for sure. But I know there were other instances where the property owner wanted to keep their property, and so their yard was remediated regardless of that cost.
This is Barry. I think I've only seen that one time, and that was where someone was living on a property that was not meant to be a residential property. It was an old industrial site, and so it was very impacted because that's where a lot of the waste handling occurred. So rather than clean up an old industrial small property to a residential level, I believe they were offered money to move out. But that, again, is just one individual property on many, many properties that I've seen.
Yeah, I agree with Barry. That's really a rare situation. That was only that one case that I ever encountered that as well.
Thanks. The next question, how about other common heavy metals like copper, zinc, or cadmium? Are those considered fully bioavailable?
So these kinds of analyses could be done with those as well. And there's been various, you know, small site-specific evaluations where you would go through where people have evaluated those, but there isn't the level of focus on those different metals as there has been on lead and arsenic. And this kind of goes back to what Anita showed in the introduction about, you know, those top chemicals on NPL sites, and that's how people really prioritize how they evaluate. But absolutely, these methods should be applicable to those same kinds of metals. The big caveat is that when you're doing risk assessment, you would really need to do an animal model to be able to look at that. The only reason that we're comfortable with using these in vitro methods for looking at lead and arsenic, for example, is because there's been a huge amount of information where they've looked at the in vitro and compared it to in vivo, and they've come up with those in vivo, in vitro correlations, and we've gotten to the point where we feel comfortable that the in vitro data can be used to make these risk decisions, these risk management decisions. But for those other metals, you know, that same kind of level of work has not been done. But you could absolutely evaluate the bioavailability of them using similar methods that we talk about here. And there's still definitely some good information in our guidance document about that. We talk a lot about, there's the whole section on methodology that talks about in vivo methods, and there's some good resources in there that you could try to focus on doing that kind of in vivo study on any of those other heavy metals.
Thank you. So the next question, is there a regulatory requirement to carry out bioavailability testing for sites before they are converted to residential areas?
There's no requirement that I'm aware of anywhere. I mean, bioavailability typically is always it will typically give you a lower number than 100%. I say typically because you know laboratory can have different things in the lab can happen, and conceivably lead bioavailability could be higher than 100%. But there are not there is not any requirements that I'm aware of at this time, because really what it would do would mostly lower your remedial goals or your cleanup goals if you applied bioavailability.
Great, thanks. And we have one last question. For residential sites with lead contamination, was there any correlation found with elevated blood levels in residents, particularly children?
This is Barry, and I'll just say that, yes, there are various Superfund sites, you know, also called NPL sites, where lead is the primary chemical of concern and where there have been measured elevated blood lead levels in children. So, yes, that there are instances where that is the case.
Okay, well, that concludes this training. Thank you for all your questions today, and thank you to our trainers for their great responses. If you need further clarification on any answers or would like to ask more questions, feel free to email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we will follow up with our trainers to answer any questions. Or you are welcome to follow up with our trainers directly. Right now, I'm going to pull up our feedback form for you to complete. As a reminder, we do archive our training classes, so if you are unable to join our live classes, you are welcome to access our archives. Thank you again to our expert trainers for being here today and for their contribution to the ITRC guidance document, and a special thanks to our participants. We appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedules to join us. And with that, we wish everyone a great rest of the day, and we hope to see you join us for